All right, so I'm Sven Speaker, the current director of the Graduate Center for Literary Research at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and it's my great honor to welcome you all to this event, a roundtable discussion entitled Rereading Socialist Realism. Now, I'd like to very briefly give you a sense of what this panel will be touching on, which is essentially questions of figuration in the global post-war era, with specific reference to the utopian potential of socialist realism. Embedding Eastern European art in a global context, the participants want to investigate the social function of socialist realism in various socialist countries, placing them in relation to other politically engaged art forms. Apart from this, they'd like to look at different national historiographies and ask how these, in their turn, determine different perspectives on socialist realism. And the convener and the organizer of this panel is Constanze Fritsch. She is a PhD researcher at the Stiftung Humboldt Forum at the Berliner Schloss, an art historian and curator who specializes in the art of the GDR and the former Eastern Europe. She holds a doctorate from the Catholic University in Eichstätt-Ingolstadt in Germany and is a former member of the À Chacun son Réel research project run by the German Forum for Art History in Paris. She completed an academic traineeship with Staatliche Kunstsammlungen in Dresden and has been on the academic staff at the Bauhaus University in Weimar and at the Academy of Fine Arts in Dresden. She also worked as an academic assistant at the Institut National d'Histoire de l'Art in Paris. She has curated several exhibitions in Germany, France, and Croatia in a freelance capacity, and currently she participates in the research project Confrontations, Sessions in East European History, which is run by the Post-Socialist Art Center at the Institute for Advanced Studies at University College in London. And the title of Constanze's talk is Socialist Realism as Epistemological Teleology in the GDR. Constanze, please go ahead.
Thank you very much for having us. So I would like to present socialist realism as a concept, as a discourse, and as a worldview, as a way of looking at the social function of art, ultimately as an epistemological, a theology, because socialist realism, as already mentioned, is a projection of the socialist world that is to be constituted according to the norms and dogma of Marxism-Leninism. Epistemologically, because socialist realism produces knowledge about the socialist world to be constituted and analyzes the extent to which the transformation to socialism has already progressed. In the GDR, socialist realism turns out to be a utopia of the promise of a socialist and thus better world, an institutionalized and imposed utopia, of course, that authoritatively and dogmatically establishes norms that are supposed to realize a socialist future in the now. In the following, I would like to focus on two aspects in particular: historical temporal idea and the educational idea, before I also introduce a little bit the historical steps of evolution of socialist realism in the GDR. So on the one hand, socialist realism is a vision of the future, which, however, is to be realized in the here and now and is a promising prophecy of an ideal of socialism in the present. On the other hand, socialist realism must always provide an analysis of the historical position, since in the Marxist-Leninist view, history is a progression towards the fulfillment of socialism. On this ladder, to put it metaphorically, towards the socialist ideal, the subjects position themselves at certain stages of social and economic development, which must be grasped and critically analyzed in terms of their progression towards socialism. Socialist realism is an ethical phenomenon of the post-war period to which the artist devotes himself or herself as an executing object in order to realize the socialist utopia. However, the artist himself or herself must first be produced and constituted and educated by socialist realism as a subject that can artistically, in a second step, produce the socialist world. The basis for the theory of reflection, which is the fundamental principle of socialist realism, for Erhard John, one of the main theoreticians of socialist realism in the GDR in particular, was formulated by Lenin in 1908 in his work Materialism and Empirical Criticism. In 1932, Maxim Gorky introduced the term socialist realism, which was consolidated in 1934 in Zhdanov's speech at the All-Union Congress. Art should participate in the creative process of socialism. Johannes R. Becher, the later Minister of Culture of the GDR, who was exiled in the Soviet Union, was one of the main of the many speakers at this conference. And here I quote Hall Forster. Quoting Stalin's infamous exhortation that artists and writers should become the engineers of human souls, Zhdanov and Stalin actually echoed the theory of the pre-revolutionary aesthetician Alexander Bogdanov, who had spoken of literature as a practice that should organize workers and the oppressed in the struggle for the final destruction of all kinds of exploitation. He stated artists should depict reality and its revolutionary development, but that they should also educate the workers, the worker in the utopian spirit of communism. End of quote. As early as 1932, Stalin said in a secret meeting in Gorky's apartment, I quote him, "If the artist is going to depict life correctly, he cannot fail to observe and point out what is leading toward socialism. So this will be socialist realism." End of quote. His chief cultural commissar was Zhdanov. In the Stalinist Soviet Union, socialist realism was formulated as an aesthetic pedagogical model. At the first All-Union Congress of Soviet Writers in 1934, that I already mentioned, its concept was shaped by appropriating a wide variety of models. In the 1930s, the Enlightenment, in particular, served as a model for Soviet socialist realism in order to connect the particular with the general. Katharina Clark explains, the Stalinist aesthetic of or beautiful was not self-valuable or autonomous, but was incorporated into an ideological system at its nodal point. The beautiful was also represented as being the harmonious, in effect, that which marries the subjective to the objective in concrete actuality. End of quote. Just as Soviet socialist realism appropriated the moral values of the Enlightenment, the German exilees in the Soviet Union introduced the Soviet model of socialist realism in the Soviet occupation zone after their return to Germany in order to reshape it. They wanted to build on the utopian ideal of the 1930s. And here I quote Katharina Clark again, "The ideal that stood before the country, so that is the Soviet Union, in the 1930s was an aesthetic state and Kunststaat that will stand for a social and political community that accords primacy, although not exclusiveness, to the aesthetic dimension in human consciousness and activity." End of quote. Socialist realism was based on the idea that aesthetic forms incorporate ideology. And here I quote her again, "The aesthetic provided a critical interface between politics and mores in systematizing the value system and working out a code of values and behavior." On April 3rd, 1945, the group Olbricht, a group of nine communists exiled in Moscow, landed in Kalau, 60 kilometers from Frankfurt Oder, to introduce the Soviet model, which was legitimized by the law introduced by the SMAT, so this kind of Soviet order in the Soviet occupied zone in Germany. The Soviet model was introduced on June 9 of 1945 by this group. Also, the Zhdanov era followed from 1946 to 1952, which provoked the anti-formalism debates against cosmopolitanism and modern art. The GDR went its own way in the formulation of socialist realism, and now we go a little bit in this direction. In November 48, with his article on the formalist direction in German painting in the Tägliche Rundschau, Soviet Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Dimchitz, head of the SMAT's cultural department, opened the first formalism campaign. He accused Western modernism of an unbridled intuition that leads to a pessimistic attitude towards the world and a deep disbelief in the spiritual powers of man. This critique was immediately taken up by various German authors and continued in further articles. Under the pseudonym Anne Orloff, the second intensified phase of the formalism campaign was proclaimed in 1941 with the article Wege and Irrwege der modernen Kunst, so paths and eroded paths to modern art. The pseudonym, so Anne Orloff, stood for articles that were approved by the Soviet High Commissioner Vladimir Semyonov in Karlshorst, so in Karlshorst in Berlin. Based on the language of the infamous Degenerate Art Campaign of 1937, so this Nazi campaign, this article also called for an iconoclasm against modernism in order to initiate the fight against formalism in art and literature for a progressive German culture. What followed out of these formalism campaigns were this kind of what is called Aufbau Kunst, so this kind of art that honors and spread out the kind of reconstruction of East Germany that became GDR in 1949 with these kind of buildings. And also it honored a lot this kind of the coming together of the workers with the painters. So as you can see here, there is a painter who is approved by a worker, which will be much more strengthened by the Bitterfelder Conference in 1959, what I will say now. So in the Bitterfelder Way, which was started in the first Bitterfeld Conference in April 1949, paved the way for the Bitterfelder Way, whose program envisaged the unity of art and life and the overcome of the gulf between art and the people through the promotion of popular and amateur art. Ultimately, it was about social control of artists by the social client. The birth of a socialist brigade was also to be the birth of an art determined or at least decisively influenced by the patrons that are the workers. So here you can see a painting by Heinrich Witz, who was one of the main actors of this Bitterfelder Way and who was really protected and really also welcomed by this new policy of the Bitterfelder Way. And the name, the New Beginning, is this kind of symbol of this kind of new beginning of the GR and this new phase of the Bitterfelder Way. And here you can see this kind of socialist brigades that were also promoted by this Bitterfelder Way. And also this kind of amateur art that now the workers would be brought to art, so they would be educated by art, and art would be brought to them by theaters, by paintings, and also by literature, and they would also be invited to be part of it, so by also painting themselves, playing theater themselves, and also, of course, joining all of these kind of art events. And here you can see one of the most popular images of this kind of brigades. A representation of this brigade is really also promoted workers' collective and also how they work together. This is a picture by Harry Blume, and he promoted this kind of new way also of painting by this group of painters of Leipzig. And this Heinrich Witz, who was one of the main promoters of Bitterfelder Way, he just looks at us in the foreground of the picture. And here is also one of the main famous pictures of socialist realism by Walter Wamacker, who was one of the main representatives of socialist realism. And this is one of the icons of socialist realism called At the Beach, where you can see this young couple. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Constanze. So we'll move on to the second one, which is going to be by Magdalena Moskalevich. Magda is an art historian, a curator, and an editor who specializes in art from the former Eastern Europe in a global context. She was awarded a PhD in art history from Adam Mickiewicz University in Poznan in 2012. And she's been engaged in the international research into Eastern European art histories for a decade. In 2010 to 11, she was a core group participant in Unfolding Narratives, Art Histories in East Central Europe after 1989, organized by the Clark Institute and funded by the Getty Institute. As an Andrew Mellon postdoctoral CMAP fellow at the Museum of Modern Art in 2012 to 15, Magda conducted research and organized academic programs for the Eastern European branch of MoMA's Global Research Initiative, CMAP. Currently, she is a participant in the research project Confrontations Sessions in East European Art History, which is run by the Post-Socialist Art Centre at the Institute for Advanced Studies at University College in London. And Magda's talk today is entitled Socialist Realism and Socialist Modernism in the People's Republic of Poland. Magda, please go ahead.
Thank you, Sven, and thanks, Constanze, for the invitation. I would like to talk about the situation in Poland, about socialist realism, but also about the much longer period after the pretty short-lived socialist realism that I refer to as socialist modernism, although this is very unorthodox, and I'm going to speak about that as well. I will talk a little bit about how the Stalinist art system worked in Poland. I will talk a bit about artists who subscribed to the style and give you two very different examples. And then I will talk about socialist modernism and also about the historiography of socialist realism after 1989. The Stalinist art system was introduced in Poland around 1949 as a result of this doctrine of Zhdanovism that Constanze just discussed. It was a part of the general consolidation of Soviet communist power across the satellites, which meant there was a really broad impact onto the society at large. But focusing on art scene specifically, it meant a consolidation of the art system into a system managed by one association of Polish artists known as SPAP, so the Association of Polish Artists, Związek Polskich Artystów Plastyków, that organized one centralized exhibition every year, that ran one journal, so other journals were outlawed and closed, and that also essentially managed access to materials for artists and access to commissions. An artist could become a member of the association if they had a graduate degree in arts. There was essentially no other point of access. They could also be kicked out of it, which meant being cut off from any way of, again, access to art materials such as paint or clay and any commission. So it was really the to be or not to be of an artist existing within that system. As I mentioned, there were general exhibitions organized annually by the Association of Polish Artists. They were held initially at the National Museum in Warsaw. There were ultimately only four of these exhibitions, the first in 1950, and the last one took place in 1954. And here you're showing, I'm showing you a film still from a newsreel from 1950, showing the opening of the exhibition, a group of men and some women looking at a sculpture by Atanasy Wiśniewski that won the first prize in the sculpture section. And then you see also the first prize for painting given to Wojciech Weiss for his large-scale painting Manifest from 1950. Interesting, Wojciech Weiss was an artist who started in the late 19th century. He was a symbolist painter who also died that year. So it was really the very last moment in his art making and very different to things that he had made before. Here you see posters for the additional second and third exhibitions, again called Opor and the Art Exhibition. The interesting thing here is that this exhibition essentially ran on what we could call and consider a salon model. So artists would submit their propositions to the exhibition. There was a jury that ultimately decided what goes into the show. A slight interesting difference that shows the type of patronage that the communist state created for the artist is that the submissions were decided based on or accepted based on sketches. And then if a submission was accepted, the artist would be given funds to actually realize. So there was already an upfront advance for the artist to be able to even make the artwork. On the one hand, it's a model we're used to, right? Submissions still today in contemporary art, but on the other, it really showed this like strong commitment to state patronage. And now, one thing that was also the case is that effectively starting with the second exhibition that opened in 51, there was also a political board.
So there was a jury of artists, and here you see the jury filmed again for a Polish newsreel. You see a show of hands of mostly men in that jury, in a public voting and evaluation of what comes and what doesn't into the show. But in reality, there was also a political board who made the final decision of what can be accepted, what cannot. So it was a tightly controlled system, even if it was also a system really supportive of the artists. So essentially, this is really still running on this idea of a salon and of an academic salon, which you can see in the way this is organized. And in addition to these annual central exhibition, there was also one magazine called Przegląd Artystyczny, the Art Review, which published articles about what the art of socialist realism and of Stalinism essentially should look like. It reproduced some Soviet models, which is very interesting, so that Polish artists could follow, you know, what the doctrine is supposed to be. But very interestingly, and very unlike really the situation in the other countries of the Soviet bloc, it also included articles that really grounded this new tradition of Stalinist realism in Western European tradition. And here at the bottom, you see a shot of an article written by Juliusz Starzyński about the tradition of 19th century French realism being presented as the ground for why we should actually paint realistically, right? So it's a very unexpected model that is being put forth in this main only art journal magazine. And let me show you two different artists, just as an example of what that Polish socialist realism actually looked like. This painting by Aleksander Kobzy was given a third prize at the first All Poland exhibition. This is also the textbook example that essentially every high school graduate in Poland knows from just being reproduced over and over again as an example of what communist era art looks like. And Kobzy was a very prolific artist who essentially started in the very late 1940s. So he had no tradition of working in any different style. He was a professor at the art school in Warsaw, in a way, a very typical socialist realist hero, painting workers, painting political parades. Very interestingly, he went to China and Vietnam on an official delegation in 1953, and the work he made there was presented at the Polish Pavilion at the Venice Biennale in 1954. So this is art that is also exported both east and west. And another example, a very different artist who also subscribed in the early 1950s to socialist realism, the avant-garde painter Henryk Stażewski, that you might know otherwise because he's essentially very celebrated as both an early 20th century avant-garde artist who was active in the 1920s and 1930s, very much in Poland and Europe as well. And you also might recognize him as a neo avant-garde artist because he had a very long life and very active in the 60s and 70s and only dies in the late 1980s. I'm showing you an example of his work from 1930, an architect, a composition. And then I'm showing you an example of his work from circa 1950, where he is using what we would still call the language of abstraction. We see some Leger there. A very big influence on Polish modernism was Leger. But the topics are already just what we could recognize as Stalinist topics, right? We see a group of architects, engineers, intellectual workers essentially like planning buildings, and then we see physical laborers executing them in the background. But then around 1950, Starzewski also made this painting, On the Unified Land, which we see has nothing of that a tradition of constructivism or even modernism, but very typical realist glorifying, right, like the perspective onto the tractor driver. So we see a very different path than the path of Aleksander Kobzy, right, that like gets there seemingly just like out of ordinary and not in any way that we think of art progressing in the early 20th century. Now, this is what Stażewski's work looks like after 1956, so after the thaw. In the 60s, Stażewski makes these architectural compositions and reliefs that really go back to his work from the 1930s, kind of skipping over that period of what happened to his art around 1950. The same, very interestingly, happens to Aleksander Kobzy. Aleksander Kobzy transforms himself into a modernist abstract painter. And just as his socialist realist work was sent to Venice in 1954, by 1959, he is already at the Biennale di São Paulo together with other abstract painters from Poland. He actually also received an acquisition prize there for one of the paintings from his series with these very existentialist titles, the saved one, the defined one, and so on and so forth. So a very interesting, somewhat unexpected transition in terms of visual language, and yet celebrated in the same way, supported in the same way, through the Ministry of Culture, multiple travels, multiple international appearances. He is at this included in this exhibition, 15 Polish Painters at MoMA in 1961. He's celebrated, in a youth magazine that for painting in Paris in 1960. This is just one of like really many, many mentions of Kopsday's giant career in the 1960s as an abstract modernist painter. What happens in the post-1989 historiography so that I can like jump into what happens after communism? Socialist realism starts to be understood as a foreign style that had been imposed by Moscow around the year 1949, right? And then the subsequent turn to abstraction, one that I described very briefly, is seen very often as the expression of political freedom. And the ability to make this work is seen as the essentially political freedom. There is this interesting overlap of informel and the philosophy of informel as a free gesture with specifically political freedom. So the term that I am using, socialist modernism, is not a term that is in general use. And in fact, I know it would make many people very angry because the idea is that in general Polish historiography of communist art is that the communist art or the socialist art was the art of realism. And then everything that happened later was a modernism that was on the same level, equally interesting, progressive, experimental, whatever description you want, as art happening in France or, United States and so on and so forth. And this was really by design, and that's what I'm trying to claim, is that this was by design as art of this modernism was equally supported by the socialist state as the realist art had been in the early 1950s. And of course, the only difference is the visual language. That's why I use this term, socialist modernism. I'm reading on past time, so I don't have time to talk about aesthetic castration, but it is, I think, the most interesting concept that has been introduced in Poland to discuss this negligence or rejection of socialist realism as aesthetic castration, and that was brought in by Katarzyna Morawska-Multezius in relation to her analysis of Andrzej Wajda's film Man of Marble. So just to sum up, I want to point to a number of reasons why Polish artists actually did subscribe to the socialist realist style or ideology, depending on how we see it, around 1950, that goes far beyond just this idea that it was a style that had been imposed by Moscow and we had no choice, right? In many ways, Stalinist system realized many of the avant-garde dreams for art to have impact on politics and society, as much as this need for state patronage for the arts and for the artists to be able to exist within the state system. Then there was this European tradition of realism that I mentioned, and this relates to French 19th century art, but it also relates to Picasso, who was a communist, and he actually visited Poland in the early 1950s, right? So for many artists, making Stalin socialist realism was following Picasso, like the greatest art genius, quote unquote, of the era. And then, of course, many of these artists had actually been socialists or even communists in the 1930s before the war broke out. So they were essentially following their own political sympathy through the Stalinist era, and that also cannot be forgotten. The question that I maybe would be good to discuss is why was this transition from socialist realism to socialist modernism possible in People's Poland, but not in other countries of the Soviet bloc? And that's, I think, something we can discuss in, when we talk about this comparative look, because this situation was really very specific to Poland, and it's interesting that it had not been the case elsewhere. And that's everything I have to say. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Magda, for this fascinating talk, particularly the attention you paid to the reception of socialist realism. I think was super productive. I'd like to come to the third speaker today, Jitka Szoszowa. She's a vice rector for internationalization and development at the Academy of Art and Architecture and Design in Prague. Jitka is an art historian and curator who specializes in art theory and historiography of the former GSSR. She was awarded a PhD in art history from the Academy of Art, Architecture and Design in Prague from 2000 to 2022. She was the deputy director at the Scholastica's College in Prague. And since 2007, she has been the curator for education at the National Gallery in Prague, where she also served as a junior curator for the permanent exhibit, The First Republic. And Yitka's talk today is entitled Instruction and Joy: Socialist Realism in Czechoslovakia. Please go ahead.
So, thanks again for inviting me. I will do my very best to briefly introduce you to the Czechoslovak situation in 10 minutes. So, firstly, let me just say that I will briefly touch upon three elements that I find to be the key ones. Firstly, it will be the Stalinist version of socialist realism. Then we shall look into what was exhibited internationally from Czechoslovak artistic production. And finally, I shall touch upon what was actually being done in not socialist modern. Modernism, but in socialist modern lifestyle, because that's a term that we have established in Czech historiography on the socialist period. Since we are trying to establish the comparative view, let me just introduce you to some milestones that might be important. Like Magda, I will talk about a longer period of time. So let's just start with 1948 and the communist putsch, the coup. And of course, we shall be ending in 1989 with the Velvet Revolution. In between, we have the Stalinist period, we have the Prague Spring, and we have the so-called normalization after the Soviets militarily crushed the Prague Spring. So that's the idea. I shall also concur what Magda said about the Polish situation. The art scene was very much structured like if we were in a 19th century France. Just instead of academy, we had the all-powerful association of firstly Czechoslovak and then after 72 the Czech artists, because we also created the federation, so there were two separate institutions for both lands. That's the idea. Let's dive into some pictures. So firstly, we shall deal with Stalinist art. The first milestone would be Stalin's death in 1953, and then merely 3 years later, also the revelation and denunciation, if we shall be precise about it, of Stalin's cult of personality. So after that, we can see one brief problem with socialist realism, because as Constanza said in her talk, from the Marxist perspective, history is a linear march toward communism. The trouble is, we don't actually agree over the 40 years of socialism what the heck communism was supposed to be. So this would be the first problem, the first fork on the road. If we look into Stalinist art, firstly, let's make sure that we all remember that it was functioning as a part of much wider field of political communication. So for instance, Elena Čermáková was a state employee artist. She was working in something that was called the Army Art Studio. She was producing oil paintings, and the paintings were subsequently multiplied in form of those posters. And this is what actually gave me the idea for my talk, the instruction and the joy. We can obviously see the heritage of the European realism. You can also see the heritage of political propaganda, because those are very strong socialist workers, and they were all very happy, very well fed, and note the imported grapes. So nobody is suffering. To make sure that I actually say something nice about socialism, because it merits that. One element that is really crucial, and it's very often somewhat overseen, overlooked into the current discussion, is the presence and very strong communication of the emancipatory ideals. So in here, you have a poster celebrating the International Women's Day. It's coming up, so it's very, very topical. And you can see the new ideal of a woman. She might be a mother, but she's still an active member of society. And you can see behind her, there are the fuming chimneys of heavy industry and, of course, the wheat fields of agriculture. At the time, those were really the two pillars of a socialist economy in Czechoslovakia. So this would be pretty much the most mainstream visual communication. And it was very much stemming from the Stalinist idea of what the visual art should be. And it's exactly as Constanza observed the situation in the in Germany, the Eastern Germany, that it was pretty much describing the utopia as if it was happening right now and right here. Another element of Stalinist version of socialist realism would be its effort to dominate the public sphere. So in here, you can see the infamous Stalin monument, Otakar Švec, and even Jiří Štursa, pretty much like the artist that Magda mentioned in Poland, were both actually proponents of pre-war avant-garde, and they were all pretty much leftist. So they were continuing in a certain aspect with at least political
cultural element of their previous work. You can also see how theatrical the art is. And if we were discussing the 2D media, paintings, posters, and such, you can see that the Stalinist art was also very, very much putting heavy emphasis on the holistic experience. So this is not just a monument, this is a site of pilgrimage. It was really overlooking the historical center of Prague. We also have this photograph-based sculpture to make sure that it is not really twisting the historical legitimacy of socialism. I don't know if you can tell, but this gentleman is a Czechoslovak soldier welcoming the Soviet liberator. The Soviet liberator in his hand holds something that looks somewhat suspicious, but it's merely a bouquet of lilac because Prague was liberated in May, and before the climate change, the lilac bloomed in May. So it's a very useful shorthand for establishing the context of it. You can also see how the Soviet is depicting slightly like an older brother. So already it's very subtly reinforcing and confirming what was already pretty much known by that time in the public sphere, which I think is one of the key elements of socialist realism. It was by no means charged with introducing the population to new ideas. Visual art isn't exactly ideal for the task, but it was very effective in confirming, repeating, mirroring the society to a certain degree. If we look into other production, I should also feel obliged to mention that not every Stalinist art or not all, every piece of socialist art is merely political. We also have metaphorically functioning pieces. In here, you have a sculpture called Youth. It's placed in front of a House of Culture, so a very important public building, House of Culture in Ostrava. Ostrava was at the time the beating black heart of the Republic, as it was called, because it was the center of the heavy industry. So it was very closely followed. It was very protected. It was very carefully developed. And you can see that there is no overly visible political text here in place, but it's really working more metaphorically. We have a lovely young people basically playing, and it should be understood as a metaphor for building the new and lovely socialist world. It is the brave new world built by the lovely people that live in it. Finally, we can also turn back to the instruction. In here, you can see what was part of a broader, again, campaign for the collectivization of agriculture. So during the early 1950s, you can see the final effort of the state to make sure that the agriculture was under the state control and everything was run by state farms. I oversimplify, but that's the gist of it. And here you can see a Slovak traditional farmer looking somewhat baffled, and his modern counterpart looking and pointing to the wheat field, like, what are you doing with the thing? We have tractors now. So you can see the clash of the civilizations. Also, if we are thinking about the, let's say, analogs or linkage between the older traditions of realism, European realism, it should be noted that quite a lot of the genres that were established at that time survived. So in here, we have a good example of working landscape. The socialist realism in Czechoslovakia was very effective in showing you how the world will look like. Slappy dam was really a crucial development that did help with the quality of life of quite a lot of people, but you can see it was also meant to be seen as a one of the final proof that the socialist state is changing the world for the better, and that is doing so on unprecedented scale, which is also mirrored in the format of this painting because it is again a monumental painting, and of course it also had to address some unpopular elements of socialist life. So military service was mandatory for all the male population of Czechoslovakia. And the popular wisdom was that it was a horrible thing that lasted for 2 years, and people generally came out much worse than they entered the mandatory military service. So as you can see here, Ladislav Guderna is trying to show you that no, it is actually the other way around. The mandatory military service is making the young men better than they were previously. Look at them. They are coming to the barracks from all over Czechoslovakia. They are meeting here people of all social backgrounds, and yet they are working as a true collective. And the military service is bringing out of them the strategic thinking, the pensive nature, and even the general curiosity, which I guess is proved by them looking at maps and playing chess. Internationally, presented art was mostly focused on the universal expositions, which after World War II were renamed to expos. So, for the sake of briefty, I will bring you to just Expo of 1967 in Montreal. Here is the Czechoslovak Pavilion. And this is one of the, I think, really peaks of Czechoslovak exhibition design. Exhibition design for the express purposes of being present at the international fairs was an independent discourse during the whole duration of Czechoslovak socialism. In this case, it was filled with the, let's say, libretto or concept of an exhibition that was meant to show that what the Czechoslovakia was doing at the time, and in 1967, the beginning of Prague Spring was very, very close by, is to try to build the famous socialism with a human face. So how it was supposed to look like? Well, upon entry into the pavilion, it was announced that you are entering the pavilion of Czechoslovakia, the country which is fulfilling the legacy of its history through socialism, which is, by no means ambitious. Inside, there were elements that really had direct political implications. So at that time, you can see that the Czechoslovak state was investing humongous sums of money into the development of new settlements that were basically the satellites of already existing socialist cities. And Goraždovský's Etarea was the highlight of that urbanist thinking. It was meant to be located south of Prague. It was meant to be a settlement for over 130,000 people. You can see that there are no cars because the parking is cleverly hiding underground. It was supposed to be linked to the capital via monorail. It was supposed to be also changing the entire landscape around Etarea because the landscaping was truly meant to bring in artificial beaches via creation of artificial lakes. It was really the height of utopia. Let's make sure that we can truly make the socialist utopia tangible by bringing, and at the time it was such a buzzword, by bringing in the socialist modernity. So not really modernism, but modernity very much existing in direct opposition to the capitalist modernity. I can also show you some lovely illustrations how the vistas of Etaria would look like. I would love to live there. We can also look into what was the typical selection of the pieces exhibited at expos. The Czech glass, or the Bohemian glass rather, it really has very long tradition going all the way back to medieval period. In here, however, we are looking at something that is typically socialist, and that is the so-called studio glass. Studio glass was basically the discourse that was treating glass as a material for artistic production, not a material that has visible and clear, if you forgive the pun, practical uses. So this is really just glass to make part of the artistic production. We can jump from Montreal to Osaka. In between, what happened was pretty simply the Soviet military intervention. So Prague Spring collapsed somewhat forcibly, and the, let's say, emptiness, not literal, metaphorical emptiness, the conceptual emptiness of the Czechoslovak Pavilion in Osaka mirrors that rather well. They stuck to what functioned before. So let's say the emphasis on public spaces, the emphasis on the functioning and well-established materials that remained. But you can see that there is no ambition for claiming anything specifically Czechoslovak, nor anything specifically socialistically modern. That was really abandoned with the ideals of Prague Spring. The third part I would like to very briefly touch upon is what happened after. So in the Czechoslovak historiography, we call the 70s and 80s the period of so-called normalization. It sounds very strange, but the idea is that the Prague Spring was somehow a deviation, and the socialism strived to correct itself, to bring itself back to normal, so the period of normalization. The notion also is kind of interesting because it got rid of any revolutionary capacity. It is kind of fascinating to see that throughout the 70s and the 80s in Czechoslovakia, there is no effort to bring on revolution. We are simply working on making more and more perfect version of what we have today. That's the dominant discourse. So the socialist art and anything that was, let's say, radical in its scale, or maybe even radical in its uses of abstraction, because that was indeed radical, that was confined into the crucial spaces when, because of the context, it was beyond any doubt of any critic that and might not be thinking socially. So in here, I am showing you the Prague's Palace of Culture. It was meant to be the chief congress hall of the capital, and the intended function, among great many other things, was to be the hall when the congresses of the Czechoslovak Communist Party would be held. So this is the communist space. And just to give you a peek inside, the scale again is humongous. When you look at Prague, at the panorama of Prague, you can still see, that's the Palace of Culture. I can see it from very far away, because it was meant to be so humongous, because it had to, because of its intended function. Quite a lot of the decoration and inner design was focusing on materials. So I don't know if you can see, but in here, the wall papers are actually wall textiles, and they're all velvety. So there, it's actually lovely to touch, but it's also very functional because the acoustics is brilliant, and everybody can hear everything in here. Also, some kind of smaller places for rather strategic conversations. And finally, to bring home the point that Magda made about abstraction, the only role for abstraction within Czechoslovakia was decoration. So if it could be spun as, this is not art, this is just a stage design, then it was admissible. But as you can see, Vladimir Procházka made sure that it did have some, let's say, feasible alibi, because he named the piece the sun. So if you had any doubts, this is not abstract, this is a sun. So this is also the end of my talk. Thank you so very much for bearing with me.
Thank you very much, Ika, for this fascinating discussion. I'd like to move on to the last talk of today by Gregor Taul, who is a visiting lecturer and the head of the MA curriculum at the Estonian Academy of Arts in Tallinn. Gregor is a critic and curator who specializes in public space, especially monuments and murals of the Soviet era. Since 2010, he has been active as a critic, writing on visual art and architecture, and co-authored a book on Estonian murals. He's worked as a gallerist of the Estonian Academy of Arts and was the director and curator of the Kondas Center of Outsider Art in Viljandi, the foremost institution dealing with peripheral forms of art in the Baltic states. And Gregor's talk is entitled From Stalinist Monumentalism to Excessive Decoration: Some Remarks on Socialist Realist Public Painting in the Soviet Baltics.
Start my presentation with a note that Tsarian artistic culture was at least formally not that radical. The relatively mild authoritarian rule, which characterized each public Baltic state during the 1930s, produced a conservative cultural atmosphere and a centralized art life, which explains why some frustrated creatives were initially enthusiastic about the introduction of Soviet rule. Much to the misfortune of these radical artists, the Soviets' preferred choice of artistic and architectural idiom, classicism and traditionalism, matched the one supported by the pre-war political elite. As an example, several architectural projects, which were started in the late 1930s but halted because of the war, were finished in the late 50s in a marginally different style. Furthermore, the economic system with the large state-owned factories bear the resemblance to the Soviet-style nationalized economy. In fact, the artistic culture of the entire Western world, including the Soviet Union, during the interwar period was much more coherent in its conservative aspirations than one might think. Not only was the United States spending millions of dollars on commissioning patriotic murals during the aftermath of the Great Depression to support unemployed artists, but the same was happening in Europe, particularly in Southern Europe. As an extreme example, for the 1937 Paris International Exposition of Art and Technology in Modern Life, all in all, 345 murals by 464 artists were commissioned. In response to the exhibition, the French painter and pioneer of mural painting, Fernand Léger, commented that mural art is one of the defining tendencies of current art. The mural was generally perceived as an antidote to the, quote, splintering of the picture surface at the hands of cubism and other avant-garde painting practices, and to the alienation of humanity and to the anomie of art in the modern condition. As the mural was pushed to the forefront of cultural agenda in Europe, painters in various countries were giving mural painting a political agenda and hence related it to the good cause of local identity and something valuable against some aspects of modernism, which was deemed negative in this particular circumstance. Kaunas School of Art, which was formed in 1920, opened a decorative painting studio in 1929. The department established itself in the 1930s, once the Paris experienced Juozas Mikenas and Stasis Urinskas began to teach. These two artists laid ground for the distinctive school of Lithuanian monumental decorative art, as among their students were many artists who became well known during the Soviet period and who contributed to the development of the genre. Mikenas' transition from one political system to another was especially fairly smooth, as he was able to continue his trade during, right after the war. Kaunas experienced the building boom and several state institutions received artistic decorations in the 30s. For example, the Chamber of Commerce, Industry and Trades was decorated with murals by Petras Kalpokas and stained glass windows by Užinskas, depicting national stereotypes of hardworking men and women dressed in national costumes. Quite remarkably, these works have survived to this day. Although socialist realism, which dominated the arts of the Soviet Union from the mid-30s to the mid-50s, was in constant flux as a genre, it had some clear-cut examples in painting, which carried over to monumental painting. For example, the Moscow metro station's designs presented exemplary synthesis with exquisite decor, creation of unearthly imagery, and monumental painting in a formally restricted style. Immediately after the war, such principles were applied to Baltic architecture, regardless of the building being new or from a previous architectural phase. One of the goals of the murals was to construct a new past to the countries and their capitals, which had gone through considerable destruction. On the one hand, such policies indicated Soviet Union's colonial power, while on the other, it could be considered a specific mode of Soviet modernization. Furthermore, it must be added that it was not only one-way traffic from Moscow, but the Baltic artists and craftsmen also contributed to the development of post-war socialist realist murals in Moscow. Pre-war Riga featured several stained glass workshops to cater for the needs of its middle and upper class clients, decorating the splendid Art Nouveau buildings in the city centre. At the beginning of the Soviet occupation, these workshops were grouped into the cooperative Maxla Art Factory. As the building of the Moscow metro was underway at the time, Riga's glass artists were employed to execute the panels of the Novoslobodskaya station. The design of the windows was prepared by the Russian socialist painter Pavel Korin. One of the landmark examples of socialist realist synthesis in Lithuania is the Naujoji Akmenė Palace of Culture, built according to a 1949 project and finished in 1958. The neoclassical facade of monumental palace in the center of the town was decorated with sculptures of workers, and the interior walls were decorated with oil paintings, ceramic panels, stained glass windows of construction workers, as well as frescoes depicting physical labor. One of the murals depicts workers in a factory settle while the dancers are as if floating in the air, thus visualizing the building of a literal socialist utopia that always remained just over the horizon. Dozens of neoclassical cultural palaces were built around the Baltics in the 1950s, often by the same design. However, if a locality already possessed a cultural center, it was refashioned with the help of socialist realist murals like the one here in Ligatne, Latvia. It is estimated that one third of all the buildings in Tallinn were set on fire during the Soviet air raids in 1944. Among these buildings was the Estonia Theatre. After Soviet troops had occupied Estonia in late 1944, the communist government decided to rebuild the theatre. The restoring of a symbolic building allowed the regime to make a magnanimous gesture. A group of artists were chosen to execute the ceiling painting of the Grand Theatre Hall. The thematic program was prepared by the Art Administration of the Estonian Socialist Republic. depicting the triumphant entry of the Soviet Estonian Rifle Corps into Tallinn, post-war reconstruction, collectivized agriculture, and the annual song festival. Workers, soldiers, singers, and intellectuals were presented side by side to demonstrate that under socialism, high culture was no longer the monopoly of the bourgeoisie. Russian artists Aksionov and Tutevol, of whom nothing is known in Estonian art history, produced a similar plafond for the extravagantly decorated House of Officers in Tallinn. Designed by Russian architect Alexander Kuznetsov, it is said that nearly all living Estonian sculptors had a hand in creating its gold-ornamented cornices and reliefs. It is the most excessive example of Stalinist synthesis in Estonia, where architecture, fine arts and linear park alongside the building were combined to form a whole in service of the ideal. The ceiling painting in the 1,000-seat hall depicts victory of the Soviet naval fleet. The composition of the work is partially borrowed from the Estonia theatre ceiling painting, but the execution is less skilled. Vaili Lember-Bogatkina graduated from the State School of Arts and Crafts in Tallinn in 1940, studying decorative painting. In the 50s and 60s, she became one of the leading monumental painters. Later, she mainly worked in watercolor. The panel depicts a procession of Estonians clad in folk costumes and headed to the song festival. The song festival tradition is one of the cornerstones of the Estonian national culture. The fact that the song festivals were still held in occupied Estonia in 1947 and 1950 suggests that the Soviet rulers sought to make use of any kind of mass gathering for ideological purposes. During the Soviet period, this mural was an essential part to any visit to Estonia theatre. Unlike the ceiling painting in the same location, after Estonia regained independence, it was decided that this mural should be covered over. In 2003, it was taken down completely and moved to the Song Festival grounds, where it is on display next to the artist's other works. Riga was the only city in the Baltics where a Stalinist skyscraper was built in the manner of Moscow's Seven Sisters. The building is ornamented with stucco and wood decorations representing communist symbols and Latvian folk ornaments and motifs, stained glass windows and portrait paintings of scientists and cultural figures. As important semiotic gateways and connections to Moscow, airports were decorated accordingly. In 1955, painters Richard Sagritz and Viktor Karus produced marouflages for the Tallinn Airport passenger terminal with views of Moscow and Tallinn. Moscow was depicted by Karus in resplendent with modern trolleybuses, Pobeda cars, the Kremlin Wall and the monumental university building, beacons of Soviet culture. Sagritz's Tallinn scene depicts Toompea Castle, Tall Herman Tower and other signs of Tallinn landscape. Although Vilnius Airport, another neoclassical palace by Moscovite architect, finished in 1955, did not receive any mural paintings, it was still richly decorated with ornaments and sculptures of pilots, engineers and kids playing with toy airplanes. In 1954, Riga's airport was completed in neoclassical style by Russian architects and featured lavish garnishing with a luxuriously ornamented domical vault and a mural depicting happy locals welcoming visitors who would predominantly come from the east. The interior exceeds most of the neo-imperial classicist designs which were created during the high Stalinist period in the Baltic states. One of the artists responsible for the aesthetic embellishment of the Riga airport was also able to create a stained glass window for the Riga International Sailors Club. The topic, Midsummer Night festivities and people in national costumes, was very common. But the more decorative and stylized form of the work hints that in the late 50s it was monumental painting, which contributed to the modernization of socialist realism, which eventually led to a style known as severe style, or also called back then as the monumental. Although Latvia's first significant Thor building, the Riga railway station, designed by the Leningrad Design Institute in 1957 and finished in 1960, was by no means an architectural feat. In terms of its sheer urban volume and social influence, it was the most vocal announcement of the arrival of the new era. The colossal building featured a facade with large windows to fill the great hall with light, a period symbol. The hall was covered with terrazzo floor, creating a dynamic composition of graphical shapes and lines, and the ceiling featured jagged paneling to smoothen the space's acoustics. The space was free of any distracting details. The architectural meaning was maintained by the contrasting use of materials and textures, glass, various types of render, granite and lacquered surfaces. Two sidewalls of the space were covered with the extensive metal panels designed by the graphic artist Gerts Wilks. One wall featured the skylines of the Soviet cities Riga had connections to, complemented by a mother with fluttering clothes holding a child and a dove. The opposing wall depicted an athletic engineer with hurtling aeroplanes and trains behind him. There was also a neatly executed tableau of arrivals and departures. Wilkes, who in the 1950s illustrated national romantic books in an impeccable socialist realist manner, brought this style with him in the depictions of man and woman. The passionate, emotional depiction of the figure is probably one reason these works were soon removed. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gregor. That's fascinating. Many thanks. So now we have maybe about 20 minutes, just a bit less, left for discussion.
It's very interesting to see comparisons, but also the differences. I mean, I think Poland was very different to to CSSR and GDR, and it's really interesting that Poland had this kind of socialist modernism, and I would say Yugoslavia also had this kind of socialist modernism in the 60s, and I think you can compare it very much to that. And it's really interesting that in CSSR and also in GDR, this couldn't be developed because, well, due to the separation of Germany, GDR couldn't adopt this language of abstraction because this was adopted by West Germany. So in opposition to that, and also to legitimize itself as another country and as the better country, they remained with socialist realism. They couldn't adopt another style, but it was also very interesting to see that abstraction could only be adopted in decor, as Jitka just explained, and GSSR, and this was the same in East Germany in GDR. So abstract painters like Glöckner, for example, of Dresden, he could do his abstract work only by being employed by, you know, construction site worker, to be employed as a construction site worker who decored, let's say, facades and so on.
I'm happy to respond to that. Thanks, Constanza, for bringing up Yugoslavia. In fact, I take the term socialist modernism from Yugoslavia because it was used in the Yugoslav context already in the 1960s. So I actually borrow it from there. But let's remember that Yugoslavia, of course, is not a part of the Soviet bloc, right? It is largely so free in terms of art and also circulation of people, open borders, because it is a self-managed system under Tito. So the interesting thing is that it also happens in Poland. Art is somewhat similar in Poland, and yet it is within the Soviet bloc system. And the question of why this could happen in Poland and not elsewhere is fascinating. And this is also a question that actually relates to what historians have been asking themselves, why there was no repetition of the Hungarian 1956 and the Polish 1956, right? Because the Hungarian Revolution 1956, the leader Imre Nagy is essentially executed, right? Tanks come in and Imre Nagy is executed. The opposite happens in Poland, where Edward Gierek, who had been actually previously incarcerated for not being communist enough, raises to power in 1956. There are no tanks, right? There is actually silent approval from Moscow, or at least lack of intervention, and Polish thaw continues. So the artistic situation is to a large extent just like a factor of the greater political situation, can be understated. But I do think there are also a few more artistic reasons that, you know, if you asked me, I developed this question actually teaching students, and I asked my students, why was this possible in Poland, right? I tried to do this little comparison and I developed a few answers, but you tell me if they seem feasible and sensible to you. It is a large country, right? There is more than just one art scene and there are multiple chapters of this association of Polish artists. So it's not as easily manageable and controllable as, you know, a country of 4 or 8 or 10 million people, right? We're talking closer to like 35 million people at the time. There is a very strong artistic tradition of the avant-garde from the early 20th century, from the 10s and 20s and 30s, and those people are still alive, right? And these are people that, as I mentioned, many of them actually subscribe to both the politics and or the actual realist tradition and the arts. And then there is an easiness of travel that does not exist for many of the other countries. Again, in Hungary, because the revolution was crushed. In Czechoslovakia, I think to some extent, and that, you know, I would need to investigate more in terms of who could travel more. Of course, people from the Soviet Union can't leave almost at all. And yet you have all these Poles just going to the Venice Biennial, going to Documenta. Kobzy goes to Hanover for a year to be a professor there, or Hamburg, one of the two. Sorry, I don't remember exactly. So there really are those exchanges that I think adds to that. And then to Jitka's point, there's also a situation where a large kind of demand for art to be utilitarian and to be useful to the socialist state is actually transferred onto architecture and design. So the visual arts, or plastic arts as they were called, so sculpture and painting, drawing, print, can essentially create this like semi-autonomy of abstraction, because there exists actually a really big production of industrial design, of, you know, everything from textile through wallpapers to furniture that fulfills these needs and these paradigms that had been imposed under Stalinism. So these would be just like my, you know, partial answers to this question, but of course I would love to hear from you of how that worked in your countries.
I would just like to react to Magda, because what you just said is really interesting to me, because I can agree that in the Czechoslovak context, certain degree of responsibility for building the new socialist model was kind of pushed away from visual arts to architecture. Fascinatingly, not to design, because practically speaking, there was no design. The Czechoslovak industry was very, very, very strongly focused on the heavy industry, and the consumer industry was basically non-existent. So you would have the, I don't know, the mines and the heavy factories with the lovely depicted chimneys, then nothing. And then you have independent artists, for instance, who would be weaving and engaging with embroidery. But in between, there was this fascinating lag. Another element that you can track, not in the discourse of visual art, but in the discourse of theory of visual art in the 70s and 80s, that I think by the mid 80s, exactly when around the time of Perestroika, would kind of open the floodgates for abstract art to reemerge and reintegrate itself into the public discourse. And that was the discussion whether the Czechoslovak audience has matured, and perhaps that it is more subtle, more refined, more intelligent, for lack of better words, really. And now they can actually deal with abstract art and not to be confused. And again, it comes back to this very messy nature of the term socialist realism, because nobody ever explained it. I think Constanza explained very nicely how originally it was a set of guidelines for the field of literature. So that's confusing already if we apply it directly to the field of visual art. Then the socialist is also problematic, because what is socialism has changed multiple times. And realism, to make it even more confusing, has changed again in the 70s and 80s, because art theoreticians started to argue, but you know what? Realism, it's not the fact that the depiction matches the reality. Realism is the nature of how the audience reacts to it. So if it is real in the emotional sense, then you can argue that even the abstract art is real. And that kind of destroyed any semblance of meaning. And everybody was, oh, so we can introduce abstract art, but at the same time, and I think this is an element that's perhaps lacking in your analysis, Magda, there was a very strong sense of self-censorship. We might introduce it, but it's not explicitly allowed, so we better not. So that's just my brief reaction. Thank you so very much.
Just so I understand correctly, because this seems so different from Poland, you said there was essentially no design industry and no like consumer-oriented industry. Does it mean that there are no artist craftsmen collectives that produce
No.
folk art, or like specifically designed to be folk art to actually be sold to people in the cities, because that was a large production system in Poland.
Such a good question. That did exist. We had something that was called the Center of Folk Art, if we translate it. But what
Exactly.
is lacking is the design, right? There is one kind of like dwindling discourse on what we should do with the artists in the factory. That kind of they kept the previous Stalinist label to it. And the artist in the factory was meant to be the designer. How to actually bring the expertise on making the goods more appealing, very much in the logic of the 19th century, if we're being honest. But there is, it's kind of fascinating because even if you go to the socialist, and that's another kind of worms that we didn't open, but the question of artistic education, the simple fact is, if you entered the academies, they were very back-looking in the terms of the curriculum offered. So you could have, there were studios, but for 15 people in the whole republic, honestly, where you could study industrial design. But then, of course, the funny part is, where are you gonna work? And let's also remember that in the Czechoslovakia, there was the you were legally obligated to work. If not, then you can be incarcerated. So yes, so to answer your question, the artistic collectives that were kind of reviving and maybe kind of modernizing the folk art, those did exist. What did not exist, not definitely not on a big scale, would be the socialist industrial design.
And it's really interesting what you said, Jitka, that socialist realism opened up and even integrated in a certain way abstract art. In East Germany, I didn't show that. But so after the Bitterfeld away, in the beginning of the 70s, when Honecker came to power, he also opened up a little bit socialist realism, and said, okay, if you're a socialist, everything can be socialist realism. So there was this kind of opening to abstract art as well, but then there was a kind of closing after this scandal about this singer and songwriter Biermann, who was expelled from the GDR. And then in the 80s, this was really interesting, as a lot of artists started to do performance art, and also made a lot of art with objects. The socialist realism was forced to embrace this kind of art to control them. So they had to swallow and to appropriate this kind of art to control them better. And therefore, they had to extend their own theory. And so that's why they opened up certain galleries for performance art, very much at the end of the GDR, but also to say, okay, this exists. And if we don't want to let them go to the underground and to be complete dissidents and to become fighters against the GDR, we have to give them space to really integrate them and to swallow them and to have better control of them. And also, I was really intrigued that there is no socialist style. When we look at what Gregor just showed us, I mean, you have impressionist style, you have this kind of neoclassic style, and then it comes again that there is no style of socialist realism. It's a kind of mixture of everything, and it's more a theory than a real style.
You can go even further and say it's not, well, firstly, it is a theory, but in practice, what it is a tool of communication. So you just need to make sure that the people you're addressing would be actually able to understand you, and then that logically differs from region to region. But yeah, it's kind of fascinating to try to analyze socialist realism with our historical tools, because it does work. And the main perspective for analysis still is the style. And there is exactly, as you said, no style. So we have to be creative.
The fact that socialist realism is very difficult to analyze as a style, of course, in a way, is also the departure point for your whole panel, which is really to break up, the kind of dichotomies that we've used to discuss this style in the past. And one of these dichotomies that you've, I think, most successfully attacked is the one, between abstraction and figuration. And, Boris Groys was really heavily criticized when, quite some time ago, if you remember, he put forward this idea that socialist realism, in some ways, put into practice subliminal ideas of the historical avant-garde. But regardless of whether his argument is correct or not, he really pointed to an interesting fact, which is that while on the level of style, It is impossible to argue that abstraction and socialist realism have anything in common. But once you abandon the notion of style, it actually becomes not so difficult to argue that there is continuity between socialist realism and the avant-garde in ways that go beyond style. And I thought that your panel really showed this up in you know, remarkable ways. It was so fascinating to hear you speak about these different national incarnations of socialist realism, which, of course, by its very nature, is a transnational enterprise, right? At least it purports to be, it wants to be. So then the question becomes, how do you capture this? I mean, how do you prove that there is something like socialist realism in the GDR that differs from socialist realism in Poland? And, you know, some of you attack this topic or approach this topic from different angles than others. And one of them was to argue that there were different structures for its implementation, right? So, you know, there existed certain models in which socialist realism, you know, was taught, you know, there was patronage, there were systems in which socialist realism was enacted on a structural and an institutional level that made it distinct between these different countries. But again, on the level of style, it would be very difficult to do that, even though it seemed as if what Constanze showed us looked quite different from, you know, what other, but still, it doesn't seem as if it was coherent enough to really say that there was a national school of socialist realism in Czechoslovakia whose stylistic characteristics differ from Poland. So the way in which you talk about this is very different from the way we might discuss realism in the 19th century, let's say. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really, really interesting. And then one last thing I wanted to mention, if I may, is the idea, and this is another way in which socialist realism can be talked about other than a style, is that one thing that keeps it all together is the fact that it acted didactically, right? That it really acted as, it was exemplary. It was a style that was taught that you were meant to imitate. There was no prescriptive rule, but you saw the examples of socialist realism that others produced. And so you assumed that if they had been canonized, that if you painted in a similar style, you too would be a socialist realism and that would probably be okay. And that's sort of how it worked. And I'm quite fascinated by this method of, you know, enacting an art style for which, like Constanze said, there were no prescriptive rules. Nobody could really say what it was.
What you said about this continuity of the avant-garde practices, this is really interesting because the Bitterfeld way was in a certain way based on this kind of idea to melt life and art again, what was on the basis of avant-garde art. But at the same time, it had, of course, this authoritarian undertone. It was not only an undertone, but it had this authoritarian impact. And of course, I mean, of course, you can also say, as Boris Groys, he argues very much that avant-garde art practices were extremely authoritarian, and that is what is pointed out by NSK, Neue Slowenische Kunst in Slovenia. That so it's really interesting that socialist realism is not this kind of other of the art history, but there are this kind of continuities of what is going on in the avant-garde, but at the same time it's going in a complete other way. And at the same time, it's the kind of, well, how Boris Groys puts it, this kind of perversion of it in a certain way. And at the same time, there is an attempt, even though it's a perversion of all that, to be very social by supporting all the artists. And this is this utopian thing. It's really being with the people, showing them the way, and also letting the workers speak so that that they at least get a voice, and that they should also have a certain voice in art. That it's not only a matter for bourgeois and rich people to have a look on art, but that everyone should be included and everyone should also decide what is art. So it's not only a matter of exclusive circles of artists, but everyone should decide what is art.
I just wanted to say that the only sort of kind of cooperation between the artistic institutions and the, well, factories or production sphere was remaining in the field of artistic education. So the Academy of Fine Arts, the other academy in Prague, they had this absolutely amazing cooperation with the zoo in Prague. So if you were a student there, you would go to the zoo to learn how to, I don't know, sketch a giraffe, which is wonderful and amazing. But that's the only kind of cooperation that really survived until the 70s and 80s. Anything else was abandoned by the, well, early 60s, I would say.
Really interesting because in the case of the GDR, the Bitterfelder Way stayed until, let's say, late 60s. And there you really had the involvement of the workers who were asked to participate in art. And until the end of, and also artists were really invited to be part of the production process. So they were invited to come to all the construction sites and they were a part of the factories. So they were invited in to work really as artists in the factories. But what remained until the end of the GDR were the kind of artist circles. So in every factory, you had an artist circle run by an artist who invited workers to practice art. You had also this kind of artist circles, not only in factories, but let's say organized by the city, where workers and other, let's say, normal people were invited to do art and it was for free. Some artists who became artists later, who started as workers, they were trained in these kind of art circles. And then they were invited to go to the art academies and studied art later. So this lasted until the end of the GDR. I think this is also something.
Fascinating. We had something similar, as in it was open, it was based in the factories, or not necessarily factories, but it was linked to the place of work of the individual, but it was more akin to a beautification committee. So you would convene at a certain place, you would make sure that the posters are put straight. You would, for instance, beautify the spot for the May Day parade or something like that. But it's fascinating to see that in the case of East Germany, it was so very strongly linked to the artistic scene, because this was kind of more akin to the propaganda or political communication, and it was also controlled by the Central Committee, or rather the subsection of the Central Committee of the Communist Party for political communication. So it was very, very strict in that aspect.
What happens is that there is a transformation of this model of the artist coming to work with the workers in the factory, right? That the workers are not represented anymore, but there are other practices that actually continue. And in the case of Poland, artists come to factories to make work together that we would consider modernist work, that we would, you know, large scale sculptures made in steel with together steel factory workers, for example. And in a way, when you look at the work today, and it's most often considered a new avant-garde practice, right? Like to work with society for, again, the beautification, right? Or a change of public space. But effectively, it is a system that runs on the same principles as were introduced in the 1950s. It's just the aesthetics, is very different. So I do think that it is fascinating that we actually owe it to the Stalinist period what can be considered, is often in literature considered, neo-avant-garde practice in the 60s and 70s.
I'd like to thank everyone for being here, especially the panelists, Constanze, for organizing. This has been truly a wonderful event. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you
Have a
all.
lovely
Thank you
morning.
very
Bye-bye.
much. Thank you very
Sure.
much.